We'll be continuing our series on the Python Man. From the seventh canto, chapter 13, The Behavior of a Perfect Person. We're continuing with text 30. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Srimad Bhagavatam, 7th Canto, Chapter 13, Text 30. Dehadivir Taiva Tantra. Atmana Sukham Ihata. Dukat Yayam Chani Shasya. Kriya Mokha Krita Krita. Dehadi Bir Daiva Tantra. Atmana Sukham Ihata. Dukyatyayam Chani Sasya. Kriya Mokha Krita Krita. Dehadi Bir Daiva Tantra. Atmana Sukham Ihata. Dukhatyayam Chani Sasya. Kriya Mokha Krita Krita. Deha Adibi. With the Deha Adibi. With the body, mind, ego, and intelligence. Daiva Tantrai. Under the control of superior power. Atmana. Of the self. Sukham. Happiness. Ihata. Searching after. Dukkha Atyayam. Diminution of miserable conditions. Cha. Also. Anishasya. Of the living entity. Fully under the control of material nature. Kriya. Plans and activities. Magha Krita Krita. Become baffled again and again. Translation. The living entity tries to achieve happiness and rid himself of the causes of distress. But because the various bodies of the living entities are under the full control of material nature, all his plans in different bodies, one after another, are ultimately baffled. Purport. Because the materialist is in gross ignorance of how the laws of material nature act upon him as a result of his fruitive activity, he mistakenly plans to enjoy bodily comfort in the human form of life through so-called economic development, through pious activities for elevation to the higher planetary systems, and in many other ways. But factually, he becomes a victim of the reactions of his fruitive activities. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is situated as the Supersoul within the cores of the hearts of all living entities. As the Lord says in Bhagavad Gita, Sarvasya Chaham Hridi Sannivishto Matasmriti Agyanam Apoonam Cha. I am seated in everyone's heart, and from me come remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. The desires and activities of a living being are observed by the Supersoul, who is Upadrashta, the overseer, and who orders material nature to fulfill the various desires of a living being. As clearly stated in Bhagavad Gita, Ishvara Sarva Bhutanam Hriteshya Arjuna Tishtati Brahmayan Sarva Bhutani Yantra Rudhani Maya. The Lord is situated in everyone's heart, and as one desires, the Lord gives one various types of bodies, which are like machines. Riding on such a machine, the living entity wanders throughout the universe, under the control of material nature and its modes. Thus, the living being is not at all free to act, but is fully under the control of material nature, which is fully under the control of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. As soon as a living entity is victimized by material desires to lord it over material nature, he is subjected to the control of material nature, which is supervised by the Supreme Soul. The result is that one again and again makes plans and is baffled. But as foolish as he is, he cannot see the cause of his bafflement. This cause is distinctly stated in Bhagavad Gita. Because one has not surrendered to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he must work under the control of material nature and its stringent laws. Daihi esha gunamai mama maya duratyaya. The only means of becoming free from this entanglement is to surrender to the Supreme Lord. In the human form of life, the living entity must accept this instruction from the Supreme Person, Krishna. Sarvatarman pratyajya manekam sharanam vraja. Do not plan to achieve happiness and drive away distress. You will never be successful. Simply surrender unto me. Unfortunately, however, the living entity does not accept the Supreme Lord's clearly stated instructions from Bhagavad Gita. And thus he becomes a perpetual captive of the laws of material nature. Yagyata karmano yatra lokayam karma bandhana. If one does not act for the satisfaction of Krishna, who is known as Vishnu or Yajna, he must be entangled in the reactions of fruitive activities. These reactions are called papa and punya, sinful and pious. By pious activities, one is elevated to the higher planetary systems, and by impious activities, one is degraded to lower species of life, in which he is punished by the laws of nature. In the lower species of life, there is an evolutionary process, and when the term of a living entity's imprisonment or punishment in the lower species is finished, he is again offered a human form and given a chance to decide for himself which way he should plan. If he again misses the opportunity, he is again put into the cycle of birth and death, going sometimes higher and sometimes lower, turning on the samsara chakra, the wheel of material existence. As a wheel sometimes goes up and sometimes down, the stringent laws of material nature make the living entity in material existence sometimes happy and sometimes distressed. How he suffers in the cycle of happiness and distress is described in the next verse. Translation again. The living entity tries to achieve happiness and rid himself of the causes of distress. But because the various bodies of the living entities are under the full control of material nature, all his plans in different bodies, one after another, are ultimately baffled. Om Jnana Timirandasya Jnanam Jana Shalakara Chakshun Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhunitananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Srivasati Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. You'll find throughout the Shastra, our spiritual texts, that the concept of happiness and distress is presented quite often, because this is the sum and substance of the material endeavor within material existence. You want to achieve happiness, and you want to rid yourself of the causes of distress. This, in a nutshell, is life as it is known. And most people know nothing beyond that. Nor do they understand that this kind of life is just a little bit above animal life. Animals live a very gross existence. So many of them discern between what is favorable and unfavorable just by smell. So animals are concerned with avoiding danger and fulfilling their bodily necessities. Of course, their consciousness is not very developed, so they're driven by material nature. Now, just look at the human beings. How much are they using their advanced consciousness, their developed consciousness, simply to try to get nice circumstances and to avoid bad circumstances? That is why Srila Prabhupada has that phrase, polished animal life, or the way humans live, or a royal edition of the animals. Just think about that, a royal edition of the animals. You can visualize a dog or a cat with a crown on its head, wearing some opulent wrapper. So, even the dog can have a scepter in his hand. So, this is the royal edition of the animals. That's what you find today, passing on as civilized life. Try to see that, and then you won't be so bewildered by the phantasmagoria of so many options available to you, so many roads to choose, so many possibilities. Will it be this career or that career? Will it be this club or that club? This cafe or that cafe? Will you buy this CD or that CD? Will it be a relationship with this person or that person? Or both? Don't become captivated by all these myriad multifarious choices, thinking that the more choice there is, the more free you are. I've been speaking at universities about psychological scientific tests which show that the more choices you have, the more depressed you become. Because you're always in anxiety, thinking, maybe I didn't make the right choice. You're in anxiety before you make your decision, because you have to make the best decision. You've got to get all the information possible. You've got to research every possibility and agonize over it. And then when you finally make that decision, even though you tell yourself, okay, that's it, I'm choosing this, and I'm going to be satisfied with this, I'm going to stick with this, even though you tell yourself that, it doesn't last long. Soon thereafter, you start wondering again, what about if I had chosen that other choice? What if I had taken the other road? I wonder what it would have been like with the other person. Let's say you're from Montreal and you decide to travel in New Zealand. So, of all the possible destinations, you make up your mind, okay, I'm going to New Zealand, to Kiwioka. Then you arrive, but after some time, the mind starts thinking, I wonder if I should have spent the year in Australia instead. Oh, yeah. And then you meet people, of course, who tell you, yeah, I just went here, I just went there. Oh, did I make the right choice? Maybe I should have gone to Fiji or Bali. Or maybe a completely different direction. Maybe I should have gone to Spain. So, you think you're going to be satisfied with your choice, but material nature doesn't allow you that luxury. First of all, you have to agonize so much to make the right choice. Is this Mr. Right? Is this Ms. Right? Or even, is this CD? Well, is this the one I should really spend my money on? Even if you have a lot of money and you buy a lot of CDs, then you think, which is the one I should listen to? Yes, maybe some of you were like that. At some point you had relatively a lot of money and you just went to the CD shop and just got 10 or 20 CDs. Anyone ever done that? Yes. And then, you think, well, I bypassed all the anxiety. I just bought whatever I thought would be good. Then you get home and which one should I really listen to more? I mean, which one shouldn't I not listen to? I mean, I don't want to be caught listening to something that's not good. What if my friends find out, you know? I'm the best. I have to listen to the best. And then you may be in anxiety later. Why did I waste my money on that CD? I could have gotten another one. Oh, no. Out of the 10 I bought, I bypassed some real good choices. I got stuck with some lemons. The same thing goes on with relationships, because people have no idea of what makes a stable, proper relationship. They juggle partners right and left. They settle on one person. Okay, let's have a relationship. And there's some temporary peace from that in terms of I've made my choice, but how long does that last? So you start checking out other alternatives. Well, just maybe this could be better. You see, there's something in material nature that doesn't allow you to be satisfied with your choice. That dissatisfaction is built into the system. It's like one of you here was telling me how you came to New Zealand and you met someone and it was like, wow, from first sight, it was just super, you know, fireworks were exploding in the sky and it was a sizzler right from the go. Two destinies coming together. With such a nuclear explosion. This is it. Both agreed, this is it. This is the melding of two entities into one. And then, 2 months later, I think we're rushing into this a bit, you know. Maybe we should just slow down a bit, step back and, you know, see what happens. You know what that means. That's where you slip out the door, you know. I think we rushed into this too much. I think we should just slow down and let's see how the situation looks. That means they're both backing away from each other. And then, of course, immediately you start looking around. And while we're backing away from each other, so this is the way material nature works. You cannot be satisfied with your choice. No choice, which is within the realm of the material energy, will allow you to be peaceful. It's built into the system, dissatisfaction. So, these things are known even by materialists. Material psychologists, they've done tests where they show that. The more choices you have, the more bewildered and depressed you become. Because the more pressure there's on you to make the ultimate choice, the best choice. And the more regret that you feel when you make the wrong choice. That regret can assume even the proportion of depression. Oh no, why did I do that? I can't believe I chose that. It's all my fault. Oh, I'm stuck with the reactions now. How did I do it? Why? People actually become clinically depressed from that. Now, the whole point of choosing is to get happiness and avoid distress. But what Krishna is telling you in Bhagavad Gita is that there's something beyond simply using your human form of life for fighting distress and achieving happiness. There's something far beyond that. In fact, the Srimad Bhagavatam advises you, just forget about that whole struggle. Forget about that whole way of endeavoring. In other words, don't even think about trying to achieve happiness or fight distress. That's not the business of an advanced human being. Now, this is shocking news. What do you mean? Forget about achieving happiness? Forget about fighting off distress? What else am I to do? It's natural. You want to be happy. You want to enjoy. And you don't want to be miserable. You don't want unhappiness coming to you. What else is there to do? Krishna consciousness, bhakti yoga, means what else to do? The real thing, the real life, which is to satisfy the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And in this way, your spiritual senses become revived. You have spiritual senses now, but they're covered by matter. The more you engage in devotional service to the Supreme Lord, to try to satisfy his spiritual senses, the more your own spiritual senses become manifest again. So there's a completely distinct platform of activities beyond just trying to get happiness and fight distress. And Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita are inviting you to that plane of activities. That's natural life. That is organic life. Now, there are different ways you make plans to enjoy bodily comfort. Human beings do that through economic development, and they do it through performing punya, or pious activities, good karma, for elevation to the higher planets, where they have much more heavenly enjoyment than is available on Earth. Of course, you don't see that endeavor in today's society. No one knows anything about what is good karma, or what are the heavenly planets, how there are planets in this material universe with facilities for enjoyment far beyond what is available on Earth. People don't know about that. In Vedic civilization, they understood such. Even in India today, you'll find people who understand. You should do authorized good activities so that in your next birth you can have a better station. They understand that. But not in today's version of human society. They don't understand. So therefore they think happiness is achieved through economic development. You must have money, and you must have fulfillment from your job. If you can't have fulfillment from your job, at least have money. Money must be there. And then, if you get some money, you can demand fulfillment. This is not the way you should live your life. And nor will you become satisfied in that way. Why? Material nature will not allow you to be satisfied in that way. The quicker you realize that, the better. Material nature will not allow you to be satisfied. You're coping with an energy that is meant, designed to frustrate you, to baffle you. It's like yesterday when we were driving in the car. We saw some students outside of, was it Massey University? Yes. Sitting on a bench at the bus stop. And so I just asked, what are these students thinking? They just look, one especially just looked completely just depressed and lifeless. Like a blob of flesh with clothes on. You know, slumped on the bench. Waiting to go home after classes. So I asked, what does this look mean? So Vishnu Maya said, it means all your options are just leading nowhere. Everything you do is blocked. You just can't get what you wanted. Nothing turns out the way you expected. So there you are just slumped on a bench. It was a young lady in her early 20s. It was a Monday. Obviously, whatever she did on the weekend just in no way elevated her spirits. So, there's something in the atmosphere that we live in that frustrates your attempts. Now, why should you be angry about that? There's a reason for that frustration built into the system. It's to get you to understand you shouldn't be endeavoring in this way. You can't fight the system. You see, the whole purpose of our being in material nature is to get a chance to fulfill our foolish desires, and then finally we should realize this is not going to work. That is the purpose of material existence. so that we learn this is not going to work. It's not happening. The younger you come to this point, the better it is. Just, it's not happening. It's not working. Some people take many births and deaths to come to this point. Just like when you're young, you see opportunity. Although even that is fading more and more, that youthful hope. And just by looking at this student slumped on the bench, I can see she's lost all optimism. She's lost all hope. She's completely deflated. But others can keep that false hope for a while. I'll travel to a distant land, see a different culture, meet different people. There's a big world out there just waiting for me. What are you looking for? You're looking for food for your senses. It's like, you know, you ever seen fish, especially guppies in a fish tank? They just swim around all day just... Because fish have the sense that their tongue is so powerful, they have to just constantly nibble. So human beings are like that, as Prahlad Maharaj says, with all their senses, not just one sense. As you know, each animal has a particular sense that's most prominent, generally speaking. But the human beings have all five senses prominent. So their five senses are dragging them in different ways all at once. That's why a human being who's sunk deep in sense gratification loves it when all the senses are being overloaded by material stimuli at the same time. Of course, Prahlad Maharaj describes it, the situation to be like a married man who has five wives and each one is pulling him. Come to me, come to me, come to my room, come to my room. So all five senses are pulling at you at once. That's human life. You try to satisfy your tongue, and then your eyes want to see something nice. Your eyes see something attractive, then your ears want to hear something. Your ears hear something, and then your skin wants to feel nice sensations. It just goes on and on and on, non-stop. You see, the senses are the instruments by which we seek to fulfill our desires. First, you have to understand you have desire. Life in this world means two things, desire and activity. If you can focus on those two features of your life, you'll start to understand yourself. Desire and activity. Understanding yourself means to understand your desires and your activities. Both these things are witnessed by the Lord in the heart. Krishna in the heart as super soul observes what are your desires, what are your activities, and then he directs that material nature puts you in a suitable body and circumstances according to your desires and activities. This goes on birth after birth. It's called samsara chakra, the wheel of repeated birth and death. The wheel is always turning. And you go through birth and death, over and over and over again. Prahlad Maharaj earlier calls this being crushed by the wheel of time, Kala Chakra. That wheel of time has 16 spokes, the five gross elements, and then the five knowledge-acquiring senses, the Ganendriyas, and the five working senses, the Karmendriyas, and then the chief of all senses, the mind. So the wheel of Kala Chakra has these 16 spokes. And what does that wheel do? It crushes you. Just like a grinding stone in the shape of a wheel that turns for grinding grains. So the Kala Chakra crushes you. And Prahlad Maharaj is praying to Lord Nrisimhadev, I'm being crushed by this wheel of time. Therefore, I am appealing to you who are beyond the effects of time. You who are beyond material nature. So just think about it, being crushed by the wheel of time. You don't feel that now because time hasn't completely revealed its ugly face to many of you. Although it can happen even at a very young age. Little children who die at such a young age. Teenagers who die at a young age. But sooner or later, material nature will reveal its ferocious face to everyone. And then you'll understand what it means to be crushed by the wheel of time. Past, present, and future is the weight of that stone that crushes you. You might think that past, present, and future is just some innocent thing. There was yesterday, now there's today, and then there'll be tomorrow. You don't understand. That is the weight of the stone that's crushing you. Past, present, future, past, present, future, past, present, future means your body is being destroyed. Your circumstances are being destroyed. Even the whole material existence is subject to annihilation. How can you enjoy with all that going on? But there's something about Maya, the illusory energy of the Lord, that prevents you or doesn't allow you to see that weight until it's too late. You're not aware in illusion, in delusion, you're not aware of this huge weight pressing down on you. And of course, you take various steps in your life to make sure that you don't see or feel that weight. That's why intoxication is so important. It's impossible practically to do anything these days, as I always say, without intoxication. You can't have a decent relationship with someone without intoxication. You can't socialize. You can't express yourself. You can't feel normal. And this is culture. To learn this at a young age, you call this culture? How to just drown in intoxication, wallow in intoxication, and in this way, you're supposed to understand yourself? We are intoxicated enough just by our existence in the material world, which is a deluding, baffling situation. The weight will become known to us from time to time. In fact, sometimes that weight is so glaringly real that we can't bear it any longer. People commit suicide. Whether you realize it or not, that crushing weight is always there. And everyone will realize it from time to time. Some people always realize it. Some people just have constant distressing circumstances. Others have some glimpses of happiness, some feeling of prosperity. But in any case, everyone feels the weight, the crushing weight of the Kala Chakra, the wheel of time. It's like I was reading one former Prime Minister of New Zealand, David Longhi. He actually inaugurated the construction of the Radha Gididhari Temple, New Varshan, maybe 15 years ago. Now he's dying of some rare disease, and he's 63. And one newspaper had as its headlines, David Longhi, alone, lonely, facing death. Nothing the doctors can do. Looking straight into the face of death. But he was described as being in good spirits, joking about death. You may joke about it, but the weight is still there. A good politician can joke about death. Devotee can joke about death because devotee knows the solution. But it's just a put-on when you joke about death and you don't know any solution to it. Means you're an expert politician. You can say anything in any circumstance. I talked with him, as you know, some years ago. And he actually had some insight into material nature, but not enough for taking a spiritual solution as of yet. Who knows? Maybe some devotees should visit him in the hospital of Auckland. He loved India. He said the greatest thing that ever happened to him after his fall from political power was when he was offered the post of being ambassador to India. So that was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. I love India. But he couldn't take the post because his new wife wasn't into it. He described how... But you guys think that having a wife means freedom? Is that what you all think? No. You hand over your independence. Right? Right? You hand over your independence. That's the unstated part of the contract. Right? You'll get all the sweet looks and soft words. Sometimes. But you have to, it's a trade and exchange, you know. You hand over your independence, and in return you get soft words and sweet looks. Sometimes. So just then, he had achieved his ultimate desire. He said, it was so distressing his last years as Prime Minister in New Zealand. He had a heart attack, and he had to, I don't know if any of you remember, he had a heart attack, and he had to appoint an acting Prime Minister for some time. So, I guess this is all, you're all too young for that. This is 1989 or something like that. You remember Krishna? No, you were just, weren't conscious much then. Just buying shoes, huh? How many pairs was it? 50 or 50? So, he had achieved his dream in the 90s after his fall from power, the ambassador to India. But his second wife was saying, no way. So he couldn't do it. So now in his last moments before death, he said, that was the height of my career. That was what I wanted so much. And he's glorifying that opportunity he had, although he couldn't take it. He was, just see how cruel material nature is. It just leaves you with these practically valueless memories. I got that chance. I got that chance. Well, could you take it? No, but I got the chance. I got the chance. Just see. You understand, Dwayne, how merciless material nature is? We're so poverty-stricken, so hard up, that we just glorify that we had the chance. It was the height of my life 10 years ago when the government asked me to be ambassador in India. And so ordinary, wow. In other words, you did it. No, I couldn't do it because my wife wouldn't let me. But they asked me. Got that chance. You see how hard up and just miserly we are. You know, we're just like, I saw a piece of broken glass in the street. I saw it. So, his memoirs are due out soon. It's going to be a big hit in New Zealand, his memoirs, because he speaks very frankly and straightly about all the politicians, about his own family life. He talks about his divorce with his first wife. That, he said, what could I do? I just didn't feel the passion anymore for her. She had all the cards in her hand. We grew up together. We had a Methodist background together. We were poor together, and we struggled through that poverty. Then we married. You know, there's the children. There's my political prestige. All those cards were there in her hands. But I said, no. I've got to go for the passion. He admitted she held all the cards. Loyalty, you know, traditional morality. Support during the lean years before he was a big name. Children. He admitted she had all the cards, but no. He had an affair with his speechwriter, which was bubbling for some years. He said it took 5 years for him to, you know, make the overture. And then the newspapers started gossiping about it all. And he said, what was his reaction to the gossip in the press? He said, I was quite complimented. She, his girlfriend, was a bit embarrassed. I was quite complimented. Yeah, you know. This is Kali Yuga. Having the gossip in the newspapers allowed, evidently, apparently allowed, that he could make his final presentation to her. You see, they're all talking about it. What do you think? Maybe we should be together. Anyway, that was only 10 years ago or so. Now, what is happening? The jaws of death. And you're allowed some creativity in approaching your death. You're allowed some sense of, you're allowed to manufacture some sense of self-respect. He was describing that they had to amputate his right leg as a temporary means to stop the destruction of his body. It's a plasma disease. So he elected to not have general anesthesia. He chose to just have localized anesthesia and to watch them sawing his leg off. This is independence. Don't you understand? This shows you the living entity has independence, right? This shows you the living entity can be creative, yes? You can choose to watch your leg being sawed off. Isn't that a great choice? So why does the Bhagavatam always talk about living entities having no independence? Here you see independence, right? You don't agree? I mean, the newspapers made a big thing about it. He chose to watch his leg being sawed off. This is freedom. Personal expression. No, real freedom. Real personal expression means stop old age, stop disease, stop death. No one thinks about that, though. They just get caught up in all these little details and miss the point completely. We hope, of course, in this case, that if some devotees can contact him, because he did devotional service, he presided over the ceremony for marking the construction of the temple. That's to his eternal credit. So. And we did. He and I had some very interesting talks where he explained to me how all the accusations that there's some kind of materialistic conspiracy are true. I explained to you before, I was asking him questions about how New Zealand society works and how the many countries in the world work. Just looked at me and said, young man, what's a Hare Krishna like you asking these kind of questions? How do you know all this? And then he started explaining to me. He started actually telling me, yes, it's all true. He told me things that are happening right now. That was 6 years ago. He told me, number one, in New Zealand, you're going to see that if you graduate from university, you'll make less money than a tradesperson. So that is done on purpose. In other words, he said, we don't want so-called intellectuals from the university thinking that they really, you know, are hot stuff. You can go to university, you can go in debt for it, but you're not going to make as much money as a tradesperson. In other words, he said, they don't want anyone rocking the boat. They just want persons who are satisfied with television, sports, intoxication, and sex. Leave it at that. So the universities sometimes, very rarely, produce persons who can think. Very rarely. So they don't want even that remote chance of happening. Okay? Go to university, get in debt for it, but you'll make less money than an electrician or a plumber. In other words, we'll put you in your place. He told me there's a plan for that. And indeed, that's happened now. You know that, Dwight? Yeah. Yes, a master plumber makes more than a corporate lawyer in New Zealand. Those are the facts. There's a shortage of carpenters, a shortage of plumbers. Because all the young people think, go to university, go deep into debt, $30,000 in debt, and your future's assured. Who wants to be a carpenter or a plumber or electrician? They go deep in debt. And, of course, they're studying things like history, linguistics, this and that. There's no job for that. But I'm studying what I want to study. Material nature will fulfill me. And then they have to get any job they can get and struggle. The average number of years a New Zealand lady spends paying back her university debts is 27 years. For a man, it's half that, 13, 14 years. So he was explaining all this to me. He said, you know, he used to think that there would come a time when people might rebel. But no, no one worries about that anymore. Just give them 6,100 television channels, they'll be fine. And then he said, now don't think that these are demons who are controlling everything. I know you Hare Krishnas, you have this idea that they're demoniac persons. He said, no, they're not demons, it's just someone has to be in control. He said, if you're smart enough to figure this out, become one of us. He said, this is going on all over the world in all the progressive developed countries. This plan, how to keep everything under control. By giving the people just heaps of television, sports, and let them just enjoy in that way. Those who are the shrewdies, those who can see beyond that, they can be the controllers. There'll be very few. Otherwise, be controlled. And why worry? You've got, you know, so many TV channels to choose from, so much sports. And you've got your intoxication and sex life. What more do you want? Your desires are being fulfilled in a way that doesn't disturb the control of the society. That's what he explained. I told you this before. He told me, he said, we know, the government of New Zealand knows, that 90% of the people are against a cashless society consisting of just electronic money. We know that. But let me tell you something. They're going to get it anyway. Like he's explaining all this. Like, and don't think it's demoniac. It's just someone's got to be in control. That's all. So we had a long 2-hour discussion. He just bluntly admitted all these things. In a detached way. In other words, he was explaining, it's not that I am personally into these things, but this is the way the world is, and there is a point to it. Society has to be controlled. You know, things have to be orderly. So, as long as you're enjoying, why should you care that you're being manipulated? So, he was the most honest political leader I had ever talked to. He just, at first he was a bit shocked because I started asking him questions, like, what's really going on? Like, that's when he looked at me, Hare Krishna and all these kind of things. So, you may be a special person and understand certain things about material nature, but you still can't do anything about it. Isn't that the ultimate bafflement? You may even see a bit through the whole haze. He saw it through the whole haze to a certain extent, but he couldn't do anything about it. And then in the end, cut down by material nature. And your only way you can save dignity is, hey, I want to watch when my leg is being amputated. That's the only way you can preserve your self-pride and self-respect. This is how material nature operates. The whole point of Bhagavad Gita is to get you to see material existence as a process. Shall I say process? You know, there are industrial processes. There are... everything's a process. You want film developed, there's a process. Similarly, the whole material existence is a process. It's doing things to you. You're undergoing a process. Being fully under the control of material nature, you just accept. You must accept what material nature does to you. You have no choice about that. You have a choice how you react, and that you think is your independence. That you think is your freedom. Material nature is forcing upon you. Your leg is going to be amputated. But you can choose, but I will be watching, I will be aware. I will not take anesthesia, except localized. I will not take general anesthesia. Just see my freedom. This is how civilization acts these days. Making a foolish attempt for freedom and not understanding the enslavement. Real freedom, of course, is stop the amputation, stop the disease, stop your death. No, you try to preserve your sense of self-worth and dignity by saying, I'm going to watch it, I'll be fully aware. This is all the opportunity for self-respect that you're left with. Everything else is taken away, and you just manufacture these little ways of trying to prove yourself, present yourself as successful. The living entity is fully under control of material nature, and material nature is fully under the control of Krishna. But as you know from Bhagavad Gita, it is not that Krishna is absorbed in the processes of material existence. He's not directly supervising those processes. What does he say in the ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita? Nachamam tani karmani nabandanti dhananjaya. I am seated as neutral, detached from everything. I'm not directly connected to all these processes of material existence. But although Krishna is neutral, still he's in control. He's in the background. Still, everything that goes on in material existence is by his will, yet he's in the background. That he's in the background, or neutral, or detached, doesn't mean he's not doing anything. He's not doing anything in material existence, but he's doing everything in the spiritual world. And that is the most confidential knowledge, the spiritual activities of the Supreme Lord in the spiritual world. People have no idea, first of all, there's God, and secondly, how does God act? Bhagavad Gita will teach you that Krishna is neutral in terms of material activities, although they all take place under his direction. Maya jatshena prakriti suyate sacharachara hetanayena konteya jagat viparivartite. He explains, this material nature is happening, it's going on, under my direction. Maya ajapsha. But even though it's moving in this way and that way, under my direction, although I'm in the background, Krishna says, I'm neutral. I'm detached. Krishna's realm of activity is the spiritual world. People cannot understand that behind material nature is the Supreme Lord. And how can then they ever understand that the Supreme Lord has spiritual activities in the spiritual world? Now, if you can just grasp this point, that you're living in an atmosphere that's purposely designed, designer built, for frustrating and baffling everything you do, won't that make you a bit hesitant about passionately trying for things? These days, if you have a passion for something, people glorify you. That's why, isn't it a cool thing when you're talking to people at a cafe or a party? Isn't it a cool thing to say, you know, I've got a passion for such and such? And everyone, ooh, you're lucky. You ever done that? Miss Montreal, have you ever said like that? I've got a passion for such and such. Like for what? Going to movies, you had a passion for that?
Yeah.
The outdoors?
Yeah,
yeah. Dwayne, you had a passion for something? Computer games?
Sure.
Really?
Driving.
Any car, or it has to be a special car?
Fast car.
You got one yet?
Had one.
What happened?
I sold it.
Why did you sell it when you had your dream? Yes, after a while you lost the flavor. At first you thought, oh, I love fast cars. Now I've got it. And you felt so good driving around. But then, quickly it fades. There's a term for that, that psychological scientists, they understand. They can't do anything about it, but they understand. It's called adaptation. You get something you think is going to please you, but after a while you adapt. In other words, it doesn't give you a buzz anymore. And then you start thinking other alternatives. Maybe I should have done this. Maybe I should have done that. But the bafflement comes when material nature has you thinking, I'm just going to get this fast car and that's it. I'm going to be satisfied. That'll be the attainment. I won't worry about any other cars. This will be it. And that just lasts a short time. You're fooled every time. There'll just be this girl, and that's it. No, it's never like that on the material platform. Stability and peace only comes through connection to Krishna. Therefore, when you add Krishna to any situation, then you have real value. Add Krishna to your work life, to your relationships. Then you actually have something. Otherwise, no, bafflement. And Krishna promises you in Bhagavad Gita, this is what's going to happen. Mogasha, moga karmano, moga jnana vichetasa. He says, Mogasha, all your hopes will be defeated. Moga karmano, all your activities will be frustrated. Moga jnana, all your attempts for knowledge will be bewildered. This is the controller who's behind material nature telling you that. And what is your job to say? Nah, it's not true. I'll show everyone I can get what I want. I'll be happy in some way. Right? In this way, like flies enter into the fire, you destroy yourself. Crushed by the wheel of time. So this is very important knowledge that the Python Man is giving here. First of all, please grasp in your mind the essential point. Material existence means you're endeavoring to achieve happiness and rid yourself of distress. But your body is fully under control of material nature. Elsewhere in the Bhagavatam, it is stated that the body is an instrument planned for suffering by material nature. So you've got your plans, and material nature has its plans. The more you can feel this full control of material nature, the more you're seeing reality, the more you're living in the real world. And sometimes you can just sit when you have a quiet moment in a car or in your house or somewhere, if you're just waiting for something, and just try to feel, how is it I'm fully under the control of material nature? How is it my body is fully under that control? Try to feel that. This is philosophical contemplation. Very productive. To take these statements from Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam and try to feel them. Try to see through these verses. Then you'll see how these verses come to life for you. Don't just consider them theoretically. Try to feel them. Ask yourself, why don't I feel like I'm under the control of material nature? Why do I feel like I have so many creative possibilities, so many choices? Then you'll start to understand what it means to be an illusion. They're very nice words in this purport for you to meditate on. As soon as a living entity is victimized by material desires. Think about that. You hate to be victimized? But who would think that your own desires are victimizing you? We don't see the reactions to our actions. We just think it's me desiring, therefore it's good. Material nature will give the reactions to our actions. The result is that one again and again makes plans and is baffled, but as foolish as he is, he cannot see the cause of his bafflement. What's the cause of the bafflement? Material nature. In the 13th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna describes that there are two things that are beginningless. Material nature and the living entity. Both are energies of the Supreme Lord. Even when the entire cosmic manifestation is finished, material nature and the living entities continue to exist. Now, what is temporary? The result of the interaction between the living entities and material nature is temporary. All the transformations and permutations that come to you as you undergo material existence, that's all temporary. Now you may say you're a man, but that's temporary. Next life you could be a woman. Next life you could be a plant. All your relationships, your hobbies, your abilities, these are all temporary transformations produced by the living entity in contact with material nature. So both material nature and the living entity are eternal. They're beginningless. But when they get together, nothing but temporariness is produced. This is what Bhagavad Gita is trying to teach you. So please think about these things. Crushed by the wheel of time. Take that very seriously. The passing of the days and nights. The onslaught of past, present, and future. And then know that although material nature is going on with Krishna in the background, still the Supreme Lord, although neutral, is not inactive. He has his own activities in the spiritual world. And sometimes Krishna comes to this material world to display his spiritual activities. And even though those activities are displayed within the material world, they're completely pure, uncontaminated. And by meditating on those activities performed by the Supreme Lord, you can gain your escape from material existence. Krishna is inviting you. Get out of this place. Get real. What do you want to be here for? I've set it up in such a way that you'll simply be baffled. Getting out of the material world also means that you can live in the material world simply for Krishna's purposes. And then you're actually out, even though you're in. Either way is fine for a devotee. Ultimately, an advanced devotee doesn't care whether I go to the spiritual world or not, because that devotee knows as long as I have service to Krishna, as long as I have a chance to glorify Krishna in association with devotees, I'm already in the spiritual world, whether I'm here or there. That's the advanced understanding. So please understand that bhakti yoga is trying to change the energy that you're living under. Right now, conditioned life means living under the illusory energy, the material energy, material nature, prakriti. You can change and live under the influence of the spiritual energy. Simply you have to become aware of all the different energies operating. All those energies are Krishna's, and your only choice is to choose which energy you're going to live under. The Mahatma, the great soul, is someone who has chosen to live under the influence of the spiritual energy. Mahatmanas tumam paita daivim prakatyam ashruta. Vijantyananya manaso gyatva bhutaram avyayam. The great soul changes the energy that he or she is living under, changes the influence. The techniques of bhakti yoga are meant for that. Only then does your bafflement and frustration end. You have to change the energy that you're operating under. All right? Any questions? Yes?
You began to talk by saying we have energy, we have some choices to make.
Apparently.
Arising from the desires of the body and mind. And the devotee is not so concerned with that, but it's more concerned with doing the main thing. Then also, we kind of have many practical decisions to make in our life. The question says in the Gita that even the man of knowledge gets according to the nature of the three modes. So.
First, you have to become a man of knowledge.
So, how
do you go about becoming a man of knowledge?
How do we do that?
No, is that what you're asking me? How do we go about becoming a man of knowledge? So then we can act according to our nature. As you said, even a man of knowledge acts according to his nature. So I'm asking, well, then how do we become a man of knowledge first, and then we can act according to our nature? Not that we act according to our nature and then become a man of knowledge.
Seems to me like things that are simultaneous. I can't give up everything in this 6 months and become a man of knowledge, but then I'll start acting against it for things and having simultaneous.
You have to have the main priority. First, before acting, one should have knowledge. Not only knowledge, but detachment. Bhakti yoga runs on two rails, jnana and vairagya, knowledge and detachment. If you're smart, you'll first acquire knowledge and detachment before you have to start making big decisions in your life. It's good to do that, especially in your 20s. Put in some time getting jnana and vairagya, knowledge and detachment. And then later, you can make the big decisions. And indeed, you'll find the big decisions aren't that big at all. It becomes quite obvious what to do. Because you have an understanding of Krishna firmly in the center of your life. That's the main thing. And so the other thing is actually work themselves out quite easily. But if Krishna is not firmly in the center of your life, if you don't have a suitable foundation of knowledge and detachment, then all these material choices loom very big and way out of proportion. So So a common mistake is to prematurely take on the world without having built up sufficient spiritual strength in your bank account, so to speak. Krishna consciousness is not so much about big ideas for doing things in the material world. It's about, first, learning how to control the mind and senses, and then understanding what is Krishna's pleasure, understanding who is Krishna, and how to live in relation to Krishna. You become firmly steeped in that, and then all the decisions you have to make for living in material world aren't such a big deal at all. You're not so blinded by the phantasmagoria. I remember in California, Southern California, when I was a younger devotee, some devotees who weren't strong at all in their spiritual habits, but they wanted to, shall we say, become absorbed in the material world while still having some label of being a practitioner of Krishna consciousness. They used to tell me, we're going to do just like Krishna did to the Keshi demon. He put his fist deep into the mouth of Keshi and then expanded his fist within the mouth of Keshi, and in this way suffocated Keshi. So we're going to go within material nature and then expand, and then that way show everyone what is a devotee. Sounds good, doesn't it? Well, invariably, what always happens? They get swallowed up. And no spiritual strength. There has to be some humility involved. We have to be very humble about actually how much we can cause an effect. How much we can actually make an effect happen. We have to be humble about that. A mature devotee has a healthy fear of material existence. So, if we're smart, we'll have a solid foundation of jnana and vairagya, knowledge and detachment, before we take on the world in terms of our own household life or even trying to make some change in the material world. We have to first build up our spiritual muscles. I agree with you, not every devotee is going to do that. But still, we have to say what is the right way to go about things. That's the best way. Without a solid foundation in learning how to control your mind and senses, nothing's going to work. But I agree, not every person who comes to Krishna consciousness is going to be willing to lay a solid foundation of jnana and vairagya. I agree with you. And so, it's not that they're rejected. Of course not. Just like, you know, in teenage life, it's not that every teenager is going to do things as they should. Some teenagers really wreck their life. And then when they're in their 20s and 30s, they start to get it together again and find some stability. It's to be expected. How many of you were model teenagers? Did everything right? Probably just Sri Yashoda. Celia, you're being a model teenager? Yes. Anyone else? Any of the guys who model teenagers? Miss Montreal, were you a model teenager?
I started
That's what they all say. I started out pretty good, but then when I was 13, 15 years ago, you know, it used to be said, I started off good, and then when I was 16, now it's, I started off good, but then when I became 13, the age goes lower and lower. So, similarly, not everyone who comes to Krishna consciousness has the humility or common sense to realize that they've got to invest in themselves, fix themselves up before they can make a clear decision about anything. Not everyone understands that. Still, yeah, they have a place in Krishna consciousness, and we have to be patient with them. We have to try to help them. At the same time, we have a responsibility to show what the right standard is. First, educate yourself. First, refine yourself. In fact, if you can just take a few years to get yourself together when you're in your 20s, it takes that much time, you know, to recover from all the drugs and the wild activities. You know, to get all the marijuana out of your system. And it takes some time, you know. Take some time to grasp the basics. So if you will do that, you'll find that that's the best way to go about things. There has to be humility. Humility means understanding how much you were destroyed by the wild teenage activities, wild activities in your early 20s. You don't get away free from all that. They take a toll on you. They make your mind deranged. You can't concentrate. They destroy your health. These activities destroy your health. You have to sleep so much. You're weak. That's why there's so many physical problems amongst 20-year-olds these days, because they just blew themselves to pieces through intoxication and illicit sex in their teenage years. So if you realize it's going to take time to get yourself together mentally and physically, what to speak of spiritually, that's the smartest way to go about things. And that time varies from individual to individual. For some, it can take 5 years. Some, it takes 1 year. Some, 6 months. Some, 2 years. You're willing to spend time getting yourself together. That's the thing most people aren't willing to do these days. It's like if you go tell your parents when they ask you, what's your occupation? Learning how to control my mind and senses. Are you crazy? But in Vedic civilization, if you would say such a thing, you'd be glorified. Oh, you are the cream of society. Now they just look at you like, you're nuts, you're mad, control your mind and senses. Who would want to do such a crazy thing? You can imagine Dwayne telling your friends that. I realize that my real occupation in life is learning to control my mind and senses. Oh, Dwayne, what's come over you, my man? You've gone berserk. Been hanging out too much there, Gore Yoga. Yeah, they got good food, they have good yoga classes, but, you know, don't go further than that. Come on, Dwayne, there's good stuff out there. Juicy girls, good drugs, wild movies, wild clubs, all waiting for you. Yes, this is the problem. Society today does not recognize that the greatest occupation starts with being dedicated to controlling your mind and senses. It takes time and humility. Just like when you want to work for a corporation, you just don't walk in the door and say, okay, here I am, give me the top position, I'll show you what I can do. No, you've got to work your way up. you a thorough grounding. So those who approach their life in that way, they're obviously more intelligent. At the same time, we recognize there's going to always be a bit of helter-skelterism. We're not utopians. Krishna consciousness is not utopian. We're practical. We say what the best thing is, but, you know, we're willing to cope with the less than the best. All right, so you got yourself in this situation, huh? Okay, let's try to work with it. You know you should have done it another way. All right, now you understand, right? Okay, so what are we going to do now? We're practical. Now, you didn't do things the right way, therefore, we don't want anything to do with you. Yeah. A significant percentage of, especially young persons today, can't actually focus. They can't invest in themselves. They just don't have the willpower. They've been so splayed out, so tapped, that they just, you know, they're just like wet paper bags. They just... They can't invest in themselves. They could if they would take the time, but they're just not fortunate enough to take the time. Still, we'll work with them. Because, after all, Lord Chaitanya is meant for the most fallen. We don't expect everyone to be first class. But you still say what the standard is. Anything else? Yes?
So what can we do to help if you don't have any more power?
You can't force them. You can lead a horse to the water. You can't make the horse drink. But you can... gently point out to them what should be done. And when they bang their head against the wall, you can be sympathetic. Like when they repent about it or relent about it. Or you go on saying what the standard is. At the same time, you try to help those who just couldn't learn by hearing. There's always going to be quite some persons like that. They cannot learn by hearing. They don't want to. But still, they want to try Krishna consciousness to some degree. They bang their heads against the wall, and you pick them up again. They bang their heads against the wall again. There's always going to be persons like that. You have to accept that. We keep the proper standard, while at the same time, we're compassionate and merciful to those who can't hold to the standard. But we don't change our tune. That's the point. We don't lower our standards. Going to school, silly? You can't just be like a broken record. In fact, you'll recognize, as you become more experienced in reaching out to others, that it's a lot to do with timing. Sometimes people just can't hear, and other times they can hear, especially after they've been smashed. Then they're more humble when material nature crushes them. So sometimes you just have to wait for the right time. You can just gently say something like, I don't think this is going to work, and leave it at that. Because often they just can't hear. No, oh, I know what I'm doing. I'll show you. I got big plans. We know what we're doing. And then you have to really control your senses when the inevitable crash happens, that you don't launch into a I told you so mode. It really takes a lot of sense control. Because if your false ego is involved, it always wants to assert itself like that, even in preaching. I told you. You gotta watch that. You have to bite your tongue and, yeah. sorry this happened, and go on trying to help the person. Be glad that at least after they've been smashed, they come back. Now, it's hard coming back with your tail between your legs, you know? Remember that story Mongol Vaishnav tells? How he, during his early days of Krishna consciousness, before he was initiated, how he, you know, he went off with one flash lawyer from Sydney. You know, they just plunged head over heels into sensual existence. You know, he was saying, "What do you want with me? I'm just a poor guy. I'm not educated." She told him, you're the one. You've just got the qualities that so attract me. Never mind that I'm a high-flying Sydney lawyer. Here's the simple guy from New Zealand. You are the one. Just attracted to your qualities. So after a while, he said, "Yeah, well, I guess it must be true. Yeah. Actually, I think I am pretty cool in my own way. Of course she's attracted to me, even though I have no money. Of course, after all." It's fun to go to his head, like. And he described how first he would, you know, while they were driving here and there, he would chanting his rounds, you know, while she's driving, you know. And she would, "What are you doing?" "Oh, just chanting Hare Krishna." She'd kind of look at him. Then after a while, you know, naturally as the relationship intensified, the chanting began to slip. And, you know, they just got really absorbed and involved and, you know, deep passion. And then he said, one morning, you know, he woke up, and she was there, of course. And he watched as she got up and started packing her bag. He said, "What are you doing?" She said, "I just realized, you're not the one." He was devastated, but, you know, he wanted to, like in the movies, he wanted to be cool, so he just, okay, no problem. Yeah, all right, whatever, you know, fair enough, cool, you know. We each got our life, you know. But inside, he was just devastated, you know, but while she was packing, he kept up the image, you know. "All right, yeah, it was good being with you, you know. It was a far out 3 weeks, you know, I mean, yeah, you know." You know, talking all the lines, you know, you know, she's packing her bag. And then as soon as she went out the door, shut the door, he just collapsed in devastation because he had really gotten attached. So then he thought, "Oh, well, I guess I've got to go back to, you know, Gaur Yoga." At that time it was called The Loft. I've got to go back and face the music. You know, got a face to the devotees. They told me not to do this. I just went ahead and did it. Oh, I gotta go back now. I got no other place to go to. They're the only ones who care for me. It's the only place I want to go to. So he got up his nerve. He went back, opened the door, and then our Mahalakshmi was at the door. As soon as he walked in the door, "Where have you been?" He just kind of put his head down. "I know, you've been with a woman, huh?" He kept his head down, didn't say anything. "You've been with a woman, huh?" "Was she a meat eater?" And he just, "Yuck." He actually appreciated it because it was sincere. He actually felt that she was concerned. So actually, there's so many things you can say or do if you actually have concern and care and compassion. So people are going to slip. And I'm thinking in particular of one of our devotees who was here for some time. She made a big mistake. She's so repentful now. So again and again, asking for forgiveness. Oh, I'm so sorry. What have I done? That's okay. There's always going to be that going on. Because not everyone is strong. Even sometimes the strong slip. So we have to be accommodating while not lowering the standard. Anything else? Yes?
Thank you very much for compassion. So if you are not able actually to feel that compassion, if you're not, you know, if you're not advanced enough to feel this compassion, how do we deal with other people in a way that we kind of expressing your desire to be compassionate about them without being like expressing the way you feel sorry about them. So, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
If you're not able to feel this deep compassion for people, how do we deal anyway with that?
Acting with compassion is a lifelong art. You have to start somewhere. You have to start somewhere. Begin and associate with those who are more advanced in their compassion, and you'll pick up the art. You have to start somewhere, though. Some of my godbrothers, in particular, Donald Maharaj, he reminds me, as soon as I was a new devotee, I started preaching, and I would man the book table at the Sunday feast. So, you know, I would give it to the people straight. He told me, he remembers, you know, this is right before he became a devotee, coming up to the book table. I'd just say, so what are you doing? When are you going to give up this nonsense? The point is, you have to start somewhere. If you're sincere to help others, Krishna will teach you from within your heart. So, I don't want you to be afraid of starting. Not that you just avoid reaching out to people because you think, I haven't developed proper compassion. But compassion means, from where you're at, you do the best you can. When I was a brand new practitioner of Krishna consciousness in 1973, I was doing the best I could. The main thing is you try to reach out and then be open to developing more and more compassion and sensitivity. Just like if you see someone walking near the edge of the roof, about to fall over, do you not say anything because you're worried? I don't know if I could yell up to the person in the right way. So I'll just keep quiet. Is that what you do? You see some person unknowingly coming near the edge of the roof as you're walking down the street. What would you say to yourself? But my English is not so good. I don't know if I should say anything. Is that what you do? No, you call out as best you can. Right? Achtung! Somehow or other, you try to communicate. And only if the person is very proud and foolish will they yell at you, how dare you talk at me like that? So what if I'm about to fall off the roof? You shouldn't say such things. It's only a very proud person. Now it's true that as you become a more expert rescue worker, you'll be able to, you know, be more psychological about the whole thing. I'm sure you do that when people come to Gaur Yoga, right? Excuse me, but don't mind me saying, you're in a bit of illusion. There's a way how to do it very gently. can use your feminine advantage also. You're actually a nice person, but how is it you've become so bewildered by the material energy? The main thing is you can try. Actually, some people can take it straight, and you have to be expert to see that, but that takes some time. It's like as soon as I met Miss Montreal, I just told her straight. Right? In 60 seconds, I just said, hey. I knew she could take it. Right? Don't do that to everyone, though. It's just Krishna teaches you. After years of serving Lord Chaitanya, Krishna gives you the intelligence. Sometimes you don't even know what you're doing. Krishna just uses you and you're not even aware of it. Just like Amyatma was telling me how when he first met the future Sandrananda Nyaru Roy at some wild rock music gathering on the South Island. Yeah. And then years later he saw them as they are now. He was shocked. What? Those were the persons I met on the South Island? I can't believe it. I would have never thought that they would have ever taken up Krishna consciousness. He had no idea of the significance of his actions. She came over to where the devotees were and asked a few questions. And then he came over a bit and was kind of like, what's this? So, often, Krishna uses you and you don't know what's happening. Just try with a sincere desire. Just like Miss Montreal, she'll leave the country, she'll go back to Montreal. We don't know what's going to happen. You know? She could be swallowed up by the material energy. Even so, whatever Krishna consciousness she did here, that'll be her greatest asset. But who knows? She might get there and just go on chanting, go on reading, and then just decide, hey, I don't want to waste my time. She could come right back or something like that. You just don't know how it's going to turn out. You just have to do your best. Prescribe the medicine according to the patient's capacity. That takes a lot of experience. Don't think that it all happens at once. But you have to try. And you're never wrong for trying. Just like Ma Lakshmi when she greeted Mangal Vaishnav. Sure, she wouldn't do that now. But even though it seemed like, you know, just something you shouldn't say, he felt the sincerity. Even when she screamed out the yuck. It pierced his heart. Yuck, what am I doing? As long as there's sincerity, so many things will work in Krishna's service. The substance is more important than the form. The internal is more important than the external. That's why with Miss Montreal, I just said what I did, because I knew she would understand. She would think, really nice, he's just taking the time to tell me the truth. Getting right to the point of things. Of course, at the same time, I know she's going to process it as she likes in her own time. That was going to happen anyway, so I figured I had nothing to lose, everything to gain. Right? Okay. Anything else? Yes?
So I was wondering, we're fortunate enough to have done that for some time, and that can also lead to some sort of pride in that.
anything can lead to pride. We always have to look out for pride. Anything can lead to pride. Anything. You can be in the kitchen and make a nice preparation and get proud about it. I've made that mistake. In one sense, I've told someone's cooked very nicely. I said, oh, that was wonderful. And then the next day, you know, it's horrible. I know what happened. The person got proud. In one sense, it's a mistake. In one sense, no. I mean, it's, in other words, you're complimenting the truth. This is very good. But then the other person turns it into a mistake. Like, oh, just see what a great cook I am. And the next day they cook with not such a pure Krishna conscious attitude. The result is disaster. Anything can lead to pride. But you were going to say? A devotee doesn't look down at anyone. A devotee thinks, I'm looking up at everyone. That person is more fortunate than me. It's just that that person doesn't realize it at the moment. Therefore, a devotee is a servant of everyone. Just one wrong step and you could be in their shoes. All right, thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.